The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 256, A Blip Here and a Blip There, Child Sexual Abuse in the Church, a paper by Levina Fielding Anderson, and Report from a Case Reporter, Challenges and Consequences, a paper by Chris Rickett.
Okay, we need to start on time, so I'll go ahead and begin. I'd like to welcome you to session number 256 of the Sunstone Symposium. Admission to this and every session is by name tag or ticket only. You can register for and buy recorded cassette tapes of these sessions in the East Lobby. This particular session is sponsored by the Mormon Alliance Case Reports Committee, which was organized in 1992 to identify and document cases of spiritual and ecclesiastical abuse in the Mormon Church. Last week, I received the first volume of the case reports and have since read it cover to cover. It deals exclusively with cases of sexual abuse in the church. If I have ever doubted the benefit of this organization, these doubts have been laid to rest by this astounding and vital piece of work. I do not think that any humane individual can read this without being profoundly motivated to do something to alleviate the suffering of abused children in the church. Levina Fielding Anderson is a trustee of the Mormon Alliance, co-chair of the Case Reports Committee, and co-editor of Case Reports of the Mormon Alliance, Volume 1. She is president of Editing Incorporated, lives in Salt Lake City with her husband, Paul, a museum designer, and their son, Christian. She is editor of the Journal of Mormon History, a member of the board of editors of Signature Books, on the editorial board of the Mormon Women's Forum newsletter, former associate editor of both the Ensign and Dialogue, and past president of the Association for Mormon Letters. Levina is my friend and confidant, even though we have only talked a few times. She has the ability to listen with her whole soul, making you realize that she truly believes that there is nothing more important to her than your welfare. This qualification allows her to listen through endless narratives of suffering, offering therapeutic succor merely by her presence. Her talk is entitled, A Blip Here and a Blip There, Child Sexual Abuse in the Church. Chris Rickett received his JD from the University of Utah College of Law in 1972 and has two Bachelor of Science degrees, one in secondary education and one in electrical engineering, both from BYU. He's worked for the Federal Energy Administration in Washington, D.C. and is currently employed by Utah Power in Salt Lake City. He and his Orthodox wife, Sandra, have three daughters and three sons and one grandchild on the way. Chris has served in the Southwest British Mission, has been Elders Quorum President and Gospel Doctrine Teacher. Chris says that he has two claims to fame. He is Sister Rickett's husband, and he has ancestors that fought in the Revolutionary War. He began to attend Sunstone after the excommunication of the September 6th. I have found him to be an unassuming, quiet presence, serious and dedicated in his desire to listen to accounts of survivors of abuse. I know that he has served on the Case Reports Committee for the past 2 years. His talk is entitled, Report from a Case Reporter, Challenges and Consequences.
And Britt is the mother of seven who married two of them in the same 6 weeks, 4 weeks? Real fast, anyway. On the night of April 8, 1996, which was not only the night of Easter Sunday, but also the closing day of General Conference, President Hinckley made a truly shocking statement to Mike Wallace of CBS's 60 Minutes. If you were watching, I'm sure you also gasped when you heard Mike Wallace query, "No alcohol, no tobacco, no coffee, no tea, not even caffeinated soft drinks." And President Hinckley replied, "Right." Just kidding. President Hinckley said a number of other things that were gasp-worthy, but the really shocking statement that I meant was this interchange. Mike Wallace commented, "Child abuse among Mormons is surely no greater than among non-Mormons, but a study has found that many Mormon women who went to their clergymen for help believe the clergy were just not sympathetic. The sociologist tells us at the root of the problem is the fact that men, in effect, in your church, have authority over women, so that your clergymen tend to sympathize with the men, the abusers, instead of the abused." President Hinckley retorted, "That's one person's opinion. I don't think there's any substance to it." Then there was a cut in the tape. And then it picked up on him saying, now there'll be a blip here, a blip there, a mistake there. But by and large, the welfare of women and children is as seriously considered as is the welfare of the men in this church, if not more so. I don't know what was omitted in the cut, but there are three factual errors in this statement. The study to which Mike Wallace referred was Karen E. Gerdes, Martha Ann Beck, Sylvia Cowan Hancock, and Tracy Wilkinson Sparks, Adult Survivors of Childhood Sexual Abuse, The Case of Mormon Women, in Aphilia, Journal of Women and Social Work, Volume 11, Spring 1996, pages 39 to 60. Error number one, the study was not conducted by one sociologist, but by four, all women, all of them then, at BYU. Error number two, it was not one person's opinion. Its database was interviews with 71 Mormon women who had been sexually abused as children and who disclosed that abuse as adults. Error number three, this study found little evidence that the welfare of women and children received the same priority as those of men. 92% of these women felt that Mormon culture did not aid in their recovery because it forced them to maintain a public identity at odds with their private selves by insisting on a heavy-handed code of silence. The most shocking finding to me was that, quote, five of the women who spoke to church leaders were disfellowshipped or excommunicated for behaviors, such as sexual behaviors, related to their abuse. Of the 80 Mormon perpetrators, only three were disciplined in any way. Thus, sexual impurity by these adult survivors of abuse, all of whom confessed their behavior voluntarily, was punished more harshly than was the sexual abuse of children by male priesthood holders, unquote. This study is discussed and summarized in great detail in both chapters 3 and chapter 5 of the Case Reports of the Mormon Alliance, which is on sale right out here if you're interested. And if you don't have access to Aphilia, the Case Reports discussion will still give you a pretty good idea of the contents and findings. It will also, I believe, explain why I am so deeply disturbed by the dismissive and demeaning rhetoric of President Hinckley in saying that priesthood leaders who respond inappropriately to sex abuse in the church are only a blip here and a blip there. The Case Reports project of the Mormon Alliance began formally in the fall of 1993 when Janice Allred and I became co-chairs of that committee. I had earlier collected a number of disturbing stories about intellectuals and feminists who had come into bruising collision with the institutional church over their scholarly activities. I published these results in the spring of 1993, the intellectuals component in Dialogue and the feminists component in Mormon Women's Forum. I was excommunicated in the fall. In this paper, I want to describe the Case Reports project and the genesis of Volume 1 and give you a preview of Volume 2. Then I want to share some personal feelings about this project. Earlier this year, the trustees of the Mormon Alliance, as part of their jobs as trustees, were reading the text of the case reports. A couple of them were startled during the discussion to learn that this issue was all about sexual abuse. Their surprise was natural. For 2 years, we've been saying that sexual abuse was going to be one of several sections in the issue, but the fact that they'd read over 600 typescript pages of material was a marked clue that there wasn't going to be room for too much else in this issue. There was an extensive discussion. If we published an issue just about child sexual abuse, would people think we were a one-issue organization? Wouldn't it misrepresent what we were all about? Wouldn't it be possible to print the second volume first, or print the first volume first, but mail the second volume at the same time that the first volume was ready? On the other side was the fact that we'd been accepting money since 1994 for the case reports. This was an embarrassing long time. At what point were even our most loyal subscribers going to decide that we were obtaining money under false pretenses? Even though we all agreed that the sequence was not ideal, we agreed to go ahead. The results are available for your inspection and evaluation. The book, 317 pages of tightly packed text with full index, is divided into two parts. The first part provides a context for understanding and dealing with sexual abuse in the Mormon Church, including statements by general authorities, policy guidelines and manuals, resources available to parents, criminal investigations of Mormons involved in child sexual abuse, statements about ecclesiastical reluctance to act on reported abuse, ritual abuse, and considerations for a public LDS policy on child sexual abuse. I felt it was only fair to show what the church's stand is and what it is trying to do. This is the part that kept growing and growing, partly because the record of the church's attempts is a lengthy one, but also because the list of its failures is an extremely lengthy one. In the past 5 years, a number of investigative reporters have documented cases that I would not otherwise know about, prompting response from the church. I will not conceal from you my belief that this response has been grudging and inadequate for the most part, concentrated on damage control and image manipulation rather than care for the victims and effective intervention for the perpetrators. The second half consists of the intertwined and complex stories of three families from the same Oklahoma ward. Three generations of men in one family report sexual abuse by their bishops. In the second family, five children and their traumatized mother report sexual and ritual abuse inflicted by the father and by at least two ecclesiastical officers in the ward, including one of the previously named bishops. Efforts to work through channels encountered what they call a stone wall. When out of desperation they went public, two of the mothers were excommunicated. One father resigned his membership. Three of these parents spoke here at Sunstone 2 years ago, Mary Snow Plord, Meredith McAllister, and Jack McAllister. In other words, this book is not just a catalog of cases, a scrapbook of stories. It is an in-depth look at the context of the problem in Mormonism and an in-depth look at one multi-generational case of abuse manifested in three closely linked families from the same ward. Some people will dismiss it as being only three families. That is not true. One of the last things I did after I read page proofs was to go back and count each separately documentable case. The results are 388 separate cases of sexual abuse of Mormons, usually as children, and 183 separate perpetrators. And these figures are very conservative. Where a perpetrator is prosecuted for one victim but has admitted to earlier victims without giving a specific number, then I counted the number of victims as two. But since the average pedophile abuses about 200 children, the numbers could actually be thousands higher. Another reason why the trustees felt it was important to move forward at this point was that the time seemed to be ripe for a major public discussion. The church has installed a helpline for North American bishops and stake presidents staffed apparently by LDS Social Services. This line has been in operation since May 1995, a total of 15 months. There has been no public report of who uses the line or what kind of counsel callers receive. But if nothing else, I believe that whoever picks up the receiver is keeping a log of the calls. I hope that list of numbers is landing on somebody else's desk monthly, quarterly, and annually. I don't know whether the quality of care that bishops are offering is going up as a result of the helpline, but I believe that the amount of reporting is definitely going up. I believe that fewer bishops are brushing off abuse, telling children that they're making it up, telling teenagers that it wasn't really abuse, or telling adults that they should forget it and get on with their lives. I think, in other words, that fewer bishops are successfully maintaining the illusion that abuse doesn't happen. I believe that sooner or later the sheer quantity of numbers is going to compel action. I think it may be a race between concern about the faces behind those numbers and concern about more lawsuits, like the $750 million suit filed against the Church for Negligence in West Virginia last year. I hope compassion and concern will win that race, but right now there is no policy regarding child sexual abuse available to members of the church. This is pretty incredible. It means that a child has not heard a lesson at church, at least not from the manual, explaining that no one gets to touch her body without her permission, that adults or older children who do so are wrong, or that she has a right to tell people and get help. It means that parents who learn about the abuse of their child and who go to the bishop have no idea what their rights are, what he has been instructed to do, what his resources are, and how he is likely to respond. The most vulnerable people in an abuse situation are, by lack of knowledge, kept the most vulnerable. Let me say just a word about Volume 2, which is scheduled to come out this fall. It will document a wider scope of ecclesiastical and spiritual abuse, missionaries subject to capricious mission presidents, difficulties imposed on members who want to resign quietly, callings and temple privileges yanked at a leader's pleasure, violations of established procedures in the General Handbook of Instructions for Conducting Disciplinary Councils, the experiences of gay and lesbian members of the church struggling to balance their testimonies with the message that there is no room for them in the church, and the steady, silent hemorrhage out of members who are made to feel that they no longer fit. It will include the complete documents and narratives of the David Wright case, some of which have already appeared in Sunstone, and of the Janice Allred case, some of which have already appeared in the Mormon Women's Forum. And next fall, there will be a Volume 3. And the year afterward, there will be a Volume 4. There is a job in the church for an organization like the Mormon Alliance. The Alliance was organized 4 years ago in July, on July 4th, in fact. Its goals are to identify and document ecclesiastical and spiritual abuse, to promote healing and closure for its survivors, to build more sensitive leadership, to empower LDS members to participate with more authenticity in Mormonism, and to foster a healthier religious community. I realize that many people will never read the case reports. It will simply be too threatening and too painful for them. We expect this because we've grown accustomed to a very predictable three-part reaction on the part of most people who have not been abused themselves. Let me stress that, who have not been abused themselves. That amounts to a defense mechanism. The first step is simple denial. People say, "That couldn't have happened. I've never heard of such a thing. You must have misunderstood." The second step is minimization. In this stage, people say, "Well, maybe it happened, but it's not important. You're obsessing. You're overreacting. You're making too big a deal out of it. You need to forget it and move on with your life." And the third step is to turn in anger on the messenger who will not go away with his or her bad news and re-victimize the victim. At this stage, people say, "You're embarrassing the church. I can see your bishop's point of view. I would have said the same thing, or yanked your temple recommend, or excommunicated you, too. You could have behaved differently. This didn't need to happen. This is your fault." If people have been ecclesiastically abused or experienced the abuse of someone close to them, we don't hear responses like that. They know it happens. They know it hurts. They know it wasn't the victim's fault. One of the two issues my stake president mentioned to me, he may have had others, was the fact that Janice Allred and I were co-chairing the case reports. He wanted me to promise that I would not talk to people with a view to publishing what he called their negative experiences in the church. I would not agree to do so, and tried to discuss the extent and seriousness of ecclesiastical abuse with him several times before he excommunicated me. He never wanted to discuss it and said that people who felt they'd been badly treated by their leaders should just go back to those same leaders. I knew that he was a good man, decent, hardworking, kindly, righteous, without ecclesiastical ambitions. I did not understand how he could step over these bodies, bleeding in the street, literally without seeing them. This willed blindness to ecclesiastical abuse still makes no sense at all to me. And using my opposition to ecclesiastical abuse as evidence of apostasy for which I was excommunicated makes absolutely no sense to me either, if that is in fact how it was used. God is opposed to unrighteous dominion. In section 121, he says it will happen and warns what will happen to men who indulge their appetite for it. Jesus is opposed to it. He realistically admits, "It must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense cometh." This verse comes immediately after that much better known verse that President Hinckley himself has applied to child abuse. "But whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea." Jesus also promised, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, ye have done it unto me." I consider the denial, the minimization, and the re-victimization to be nothing short of blasphemy against the Savior. I truly, honestly don't get it. God is opposed to abuse. Jesus is opposed to abuse. I believe that the prophet and the general authorities are opposed to it. I'm opposed to it. In other words, we're all on the same side. So why was I excommunicated? What's going on here? I agree willingly, cheerfully, and even eagerly that nobody in the church is perfect. No member, no seminary teacher, no stake president, no apostle, no church president. I am certainly not perfect. We all make mistakes. We all need to repent. Surely the remedy to apply then is the one that is always already laid out in the scriptures. We should bear one another's burdens, forgive quickly when we are offended, and ask quickly for forgiveness when we become aware that we have given offense. Where does this other method come from? Of denying that offense has been given, of punishing those who point out that it has, and of not forgiving those who have been offended against. A friend sent me a cartoon from the Washington Post presenting a cartoon strip, Tom the Dancing Bug, in which it lampoons what passes for corporate ethics, given the explanation for the massive layoffs. It is entitled, "The Day They Made Murder Legal, a Parable." It begins with a spokesman announcing, "We are inexplicably making murder legal for the purposes of this parable." The cartoon continues, "Most people still did not murder." One character announces, "Although it would be legal for me to kill you, I will not, for I am a good person with an internalized moral code." "Thank you," says the second character. "But there are persons who roam the earth that are not human. They are made-up entities called corporations." The corporate officer announces, "I run incorporated company on behalf of its shareholders who have given me one directive, make profits. You are incorporated company's competition." Bang, he shoots the other person. Demonstrators assemble outside the corporate headquarters denouncing this action. "You're a bad entity. You committed an act which, though legal, is morally evil." But an explanation was at hand from the director. "I personally would never commit murder, but in my capacity as corporate director, I had to. My fiduciary duty is to do anything within the law to maximize profits for the corporation. It would be immoral for me not to kill." And so it was that the corporation did bad things that good people would not. Aren't you glad that this is just a make-believe parable? My friend was Michael Barrett, who was excommunicated in the spring of 1994 for publishing letters to the editor correcting incomplete or incorrect statements by official church spokesmen about Mormon history and doctrine. His stake president admitted that the content of the letters was factual, but insisted that he promised to stop because he was embarrassing the church. When Mike refused, he was excommunicated. He has a new stake president now, but his area president is the man who, as a visiting general authority, advised his stake president to yank his temple recommend as a first step toward trying to get him to stop writing letters. The first counselor in the area presidency, newly appointed in June, is Mike's former stake president from California, where Mike joined the church, now a general authority. But he cannot help Mike, cannot even suggest options for how Mike's excommunication might be resolved, because it might be reinterpreted as a lack of loyalty to the area president. Mike had retitled this cartoon, "Why It's Okay for Church Members to Be Deceptive or Invasive About Embarrassing Church Doctrines and History If It Will Help the Church Grow." Or we might add, "Why It's Okay to Fire a BYU Feminist Professor Who Is Absolutely at the Top of Her Profession as a Candidate for Continued Status in Teaching, Citizenship, Scholarship, and Personal Qualities, As Long as the Administrators Who Are Doing It Cry, Feel Really Bad About It, and Agree That It's Not Fair." How ethical is it really to keep pulling the trigger even though you scrupulously warm the muzzle of the barrel before you put it to someone's temple? At what point will these good, decent, sensitive people realize that there is blood on their hands, not their leader's hands, but their own hands? Mark Twain, in one of his passages of blackest irony, commented, "It is by the goodness of God that in our country we have those three unspeakably precious things, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, and the prudence never to practice either of them." What is happening to our church when honor is equated with the length of your shorts on BYU campus, and when loyalty consists of anticipating counsel so that a leader will never have to answer questions about the wisdom or justice of a proposed policy? Mary Bradford talks about the desire to reach out without striking out. I feel this desire within myself. What I am doing is a manifestation of my profoundest faith, not cynicism, my faith that this is the Savior's church, that its leaders will, like its ordinary members, recognize injustice and violations of gospel principles, that they will behave better when they know better. I am acting on my deepest hope. I am acting from my deepest sources of charity. I don't know when this will happen. I'm aware that publishing the case reports will be considered not a loving and concerned voice in an ongoing dialogue, but an act of open rebellion against the leaders of the church. I'm aware that this is how they will probably consider it as well. But as I have thought about alternatives and tried to find other ways, including a feeling of release, it simply has not been there. I have tried to visualize myself resigning from the alliance and walking away. It simply has not been possible. This feeling is not just stubborn or misplaced attachment to the alliance. Even if there were no Mormon alliance, I would be doing exactly the same thing. I feel that being a voice against ecclesiastical abuse is my duty. That means publishing the case reports, first this volume on sexual abuse, and this fall the second volume. I don't want this job. I tried to get someone else to do it, and I certainly delayed long enough in doing it to allow many other mechanisms to intervene. But they simply hasn't happened. It's not clear to me, or why now, or why in this way, but it is clear to me that it is now, it is me, and it is in this way, because that's what's available to me. I have never understood why Abraham was accounted righteous because he was willing to slay Isaac. I have never believed that Nephi really had to slay Laban. I do not judge those who have to make decisions about the greatest good for the greatest number. I do not condemn those who must make moral judgments about who must suffer so that others may live comfortably. I will never be a bishop, a state president, or a general authority. I will never be answerable for the morality of the church, but I am answerable for my own. And I say no to any so-called morality that allows and even justifies the suffering of one innocent. Jesus Christ chose to be our Savior, and His suffering was redemptive as a result. He is God. He was not selected to be a scapegoat by people who thought they could play God. People have different missions. For now, listening to the stories of those whom the church has hurt, sometimes repeatedly, is my calling in the kingdom. Sharing those stories is part of that calling. I am certainly not claiming that no one else could do it better, or that another way might not produce change more effectively. But this, God helping me, is who I am and the tools I have now. I would feel such reproach for my conscience that no matter what the consequences of this action are, I cannot avoid going forward. I have never felt more strongly that to her that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to her it is sin. And I think the church desperately needs people like me. Thank you.
Probably going to be an anticlimax. The disciplinary actions against the September 6th were an emotional event for me. I knew none of the victims personally at that time, but I knew of the writings, and some of them were greatly admired, and some of them I greatly admired their work, all of them. I was familiar with Dialogue and Sunstone from their inception and read most of each volume. I'd read a lot of D. Michael Quinn's writings and admired him. Why was the church excommunicating some of its star people? I was familiar with Paul Toscano's writings, a little less familiar with his writings. His A Plea to Leadership of the Church, Choose Love, Not Power, in the spring 1983 dialogue rang a chord in my heart. Point by point, I found myself saying, bravo, someone is finally saying the things that I have thought about and worried over. And Levina Fielding Anderson, I had grieved over each step taken by the church, suppressing the LDS intellectual community. And here, in the same issue of Dialogue, Levina had put together a thorough chronology of these events, refreshing my memory and reinvigorating my sense of oppression. When the excommunications came, I asked, why does the church that I have loved so much feel that it is necessary to excommunicate these people? I do not understand. And since I admire these people so much and agree with so much of what they have written, how secure is my membership in the church of my birth? When will it be my turn? What sacrifices of conscience will I be compelled to make to maintain my membership? For me, the excommunications resulted in a constant sense of spiritual oppression and put a chill on my religious expression and participation. The excommunications were also deeply troubling to me on an emotional level. I tried to understand it and still am. What is going on here? Why am I so bothered by the excommunications? There was something deep and troubling here that I am still struggling to understand and deal with. I found out later that a label could be applied to this thing. As with all labels, it oversimplifies, but it was a beginning. That label was spiritual abuse. Subsequently, I came to the realization that as a result of the excommunications, I felt spiritually abused, and in fact, I was spiritually abused. I felt a little ashamed of my church, the church I thought I knew, was bigger than this. My church was magnanimous enough not to excommunicate these people. It had a strong enough faith to stand the perceived challenge, and it had enough charity and love to love these people in spite of their differences. And I don't consider excommunication an act of love. Not only did it not feel like love, it felt like abuse. I first came across the concept of spiritual abuse in that same volume of dialogue. And that issue was a book review by Fred Voros of a book by David Johnson and Jeff Van Vonderen called The Subtle Power of Spiritual Abuse, Recognizing and Escaping Spiritual Manipulation and False Spiritual Authority Within the Church. And I think this is all. These authors are Christian ministers, and their book is not about Mormonism. But spiritual abuse was an idea whose time had come. After that, I read an article by Paul Toscano in the July 1993 Sunstone called Dealing with Spiritual Abuse, The Role of the Mormon Alliance. And I became interested in the Mormon Alliance. Who speaks for the church? One reason commonly given for the excommunications is that the church members would be confused and think that the excommunicants were saying what they were saying was church doctrine. I want to make it clear. I do not speak for the church. I am not in the First Presidency. I'm not an apostle. I'm not a general authority. Nor do I necessarily speak for the Mormon Alliance. I speak for myself. I'm not a psychiatrist, and I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not a social worker. But I am a lifelong member of the church, and I consider the Mormon church my church. But I do not feel constrained to say what I should say simply because I am a member of the church. And nor should the church feel that it has any responsibility for what I say. I take full responsibility for what I say and do. On the other hand, I feel that I have an interest in the Mormon church because of my lifelong association with it. The summer after the September 6th was the first time I attended Sunstone Symposium. One session I attended was presented by Levine called Come Back, the Conference Addresses of President Howard W. Hunter, 1973 to 1994. Afterwards, I went up and asked her if there was any way I could be of help to the Mormon Alliance. I thought that I would be able to contribute some money to it. Little did I know that I wouldn't get off that easy. Levine invited me to participate on the Mormon Alliance Case Reports Committee. And I attended my first meeting with them September 18, 1994. On the Case Reports Committee, we have three-step sequence. First, we listen and understand, or try to understand. Second, we document what's happened. And third, we publish the reports. I was primarily involved with the first two steps. My experience was not with cases that involved child sexual abuse in the church, the subject of volume number one of the case reports. As Levine stated in the introduction to the Volume 1, the case reports are a forum for abused members to share their truth, including the emotional reality of how the experience felt. I view myself as a facilitator to help bring these stories into light. I reserve judgment particularly of whether what I was hearing was spiritual or ecclesiastical abuse. In my experience with the committee, the needs of the people whose stories we sought were of primary importance. I view our motives as positive, both towards the people we talked to and towards the church. We readily accepted it when any person declined our invitation to tell their story. As I participated in the case reports committee, I have persistently had in mind the question, what is spiritual abuse? There are different kinds of abuse. I recognize that in any group of human beings, abuses are going to occur. And I think that Mormons as a group would have their fair share of various kinds of abuses. It is possible that an abusive event can represent more than one kind of abuse happening at the same time. For example, you could have an event of verbal abuse by itself, or you could have an event that could represent a combination of abuses such as verbal abuse and physical abuse, or verbal abuse and spiritual abuse or ecclesiastical abuse. I'm not going to try and make distinctions here between spiritual abuse and ecclesiastical abuse. I will use the term abuse generally, spiritual abuse generally, for both concepts. We have to be very careful when two types of abuse occur in the same event, how we think of the event as a whole. For example, with spiritual abuse and child sexual abuse are both part of the same event, we have to be careful in determining the relationship between these two kinds of abuse. My concern when two kinds of abuse like this occur together is that because the concept of child sexual abuse has such an emotional impact on the mind, at least on my thinking, that it can eclipse my thinking with respect to spiritual abuse. Because of the emotional impact of the child sexual abuse, the spiritual abuse may be either minimized or exaggerated. In this case, however, one thing is sure. All are in agreement that child sexual abuse is bad. So there is no question about the bad result. The focus can be on the relationship between the religious climate and the child sexual abuse and its consequences. It is not my intent to minimize in any way the terrible significance of child sexual abuse by what I say here. But my focus on the committee has been primarily where there has just been spiritual abuse. Spiritual abuse occurs in a religious context. What I want to know about spiritual abuse in the church is how much of it is related to common experience we share with other people and how much relates to the social subsystem we call the church. Abuse that relates to that social subsystem is spiritual abuse. I think that there can be three levels of abuse in the church. First, there can be rules or practices that are in themselves abusive. Second, there can be rules or practices that foster abuse or create a climate which is favorable to abuse. And third, there can be rules or practices which can be used abusively by people, but which are no more conducive to abuse than those of any other social subsystem. To minimize spiritual abuse in the first two levels, you need to look at ways to change the system. To minimize spiritual abuse in the third level, you need to help people change. In the case of child sexual abuse, the church we know about, no, in the case of child sexual abuse in the church, we know that this is bad, and we also know that the rules in the church strongly prohibit this. This first level of abuse is not an issue. But there may be rules and practices that unintentionally foster this abuse. But take, for example, a September 6. For some of us, this was spiritual abuse, but probably for most of the church, it was another confirmation of the truthfulness of the gospel. So that the same event that bruised some and soothed others. From my perspective, is this a first level of abuse? I'm not prepared to say that every event of excommunication is necessarily abusive. Probably not. Is this a second level of abuse? Yes, I think it is. This is a case where other rules and practices in the church have created a climate which has resulted in spiritual abuse. If we could fix the rules and accept the practices, in the church, could the September 6th still have happened? Yes, probably could have, but it would have resulted from our third level of abuse. However, in this case, the rules and practices were fixed. At least there would be a means of appeal and fair review. So, are our arguments about spiritual abuse, or are about doctrinal interpretation? I think both. Is it possible that one person's spiritual abuse is another person's interpretation of Orthodox theology? Perhaps. I will use an example below which looks at two teachers. To one teacher, the system was abusive, and to the other, it was not. If the system was the same, let's look at some definitions of spiritual abuse. I'll just refer you to these definitions, because I want to move right along. The first definition I use is one by Paul Toscano in the article I mentioned. And he has a short and a long version. The second version, I say the long version is wonderful. Only a fellow lawyer could fully appreciate a lengthy paragraph consisting of essentially one sentence. So it takes roughly half a page of my paper. But I don't mean to minimize the value of that. What I'm trying to emphasize is, how do we get at this concept of spiritual abuse? And that's what I'm trying to get at. How do we get at it? Another definition set more in a Mormon context is found in the introduction to Volume 1 of the Case Reports by Ravina. And here again, I won't quote that whole definition, but it's very good. And then Ravina goes on after that to list 7 factors that characterize most abusive encounters. A fourth definition of sexual abuse, but a second one in the first volume, was by Janice Allred, and that was in her part of the book called How to Read Bad News. But even with these excellent definitions, I still found and find myself asking, what is spiritual abuse? Maybe it is like what the Supreme Court Justice said about pornography. I know it when I see it. Or you will know it when you experience it. The people I talk to are reluctant to call it spiritual abuse, or even to use the term. They do not know what spiritual abuse is, but associate it with a stronger context of spouse abuse, sexual abuse, child abuse, and child sexual abuse. These all call to mind rather horrific thoughts. Spiritual abuse can be horrific, as is shown by Volume 1. But I am convinced that spiritual abuse happens very commonly, that is, much less horrific ways. However, it is still very, very significant. Why is it significant? Because of how common it is, how damaging it is, how overlooked and accepted it is. I have been hearing from the people I talk to, my story is not significant. My story. The extremes that are obvious. It is also the extremes that are more easily dealt with in the sense that they can be attributed to an errant individual rather than to the system, or to an isolated case rather than the system. Of course, all cases have to be dealt with, but maybe it is the general acceptance of the common cases that to some degree opens the door to the more extreme cases. John's story has provided an example relating to teaching in the church. I find many parallels between my life and John's. He has been able to articulate these things in a way that has helped me. For me, I can deal with an elder's president who wants to compel me to have personal priesthood interviews. I can also deal with a dictatorial bishop. I say deal in the sense of retaining some testimony in spite of these events, as John has done. These are merely fallible people in the system, just as I am. But how do I retain a testimony when the whole system is being operated in a way that suppresses my intelligence and natural curiosity and need to seek after the truth? This is much harder to deal with in terms of testimony and in terms of abuse to my spirit. This is a part of John's story. I gave up the teaching job I had in the church rather than teach it as they wanted it taught. I'm not sure that it was a real good example of spiritual abuse. Here's the question that keeps coming up when I talk to people. What is spiritual abuse? As much as it may be an example of priesthood paranoia, I and a sister traded every other Sunday teaching gospel doctrine. I taught gospel doctrine a minimum of 10 years, more like 15. We moved into the warden almost 2 years ago, and word passed down the grapevine that I was a good teacher. I was immediately called to the gospel doctrine to be a gospel doctrine teacher again. We were both called into the ward correlation committee meeting. Normally, you do not have teachers in there, so it was unusual. My bishop read a copy of the letter of what the church had issued as a definition of apostasy. He read that and did not clarify where it came from or whether it was from the stake president or from the church itself. The bishop read the letter to the group and then voiced the stake president's concern about false doctrines being taught anywhere in the stake. He said that the concern had been communicated to the stake president by the regional representative. My bishop is really a nice guy, so it was obvious that he was really communicating concerns that belonged to the stake president. He mentioned that he had already knew of 2 instances where the stake president had heard, either over the pulpit or within the classroom, within his stake, false doctrine preached. He turned to the other bishop and said, "Are you going to take care of this, or am I?" Those are the exact words my bishop used. The bishop said that he did not feel confident in questioning a doctrine that we might teach, but that he would if he felt the need to, and that he would have to because this had been specifically assigned to him by a stake president. I'm quite surprised that this would be that big a deal to the stake president. I knew that my lessons were unusual and out of the ordinary. I don't really get into speculative theology at all. What I like to stress is a historical background in whatever canonized document we are studying. The bishop expressed doubt again about his ability to ferret out false doctrine, but you could have the stake president stand up and call you down in one of our meetings. So you need to be careful about what we teach. We have got to stick to the manual. When he said those words, I raised my hand and said, I have a concern. I said, my concern was that you need to understand that if I preach false doctrine, it is out of ignorance. It is not out of evil intent. The bishop said that he understood that and felt comfortable with my judgment. The more I talked, the more I realized that he really didn't feel comfortable with my judgment. All this happened in the same meeting, which lasted quite a while. He was not telling me what he was thinking. He was not being forthright, not out of conspiratorial motive, but I think he was scared. He was not afraid of me, but he was afraid of offending me. I said to myself, I'm the only one that they are really interested addressing this to. The good sister that is here never varies one way or the other. The people ask her questions, and she just says, I don't know, and goes on with the lesson. Actually, the meeting ended okay, and I said, and I did not resign at that point. I chatted with the sister that was in the meeting afterwards, and I realized that she was not bothered by the meeting at all. I was the only one that was really bothered by it. I went home and I stewed over it. I probably taught four more times and then asked to be released. In that time, I was never questioned. So I was never accosted in any way, but I just felt that I needed to resign because I just wasn't what they were looking for. The disciplinary actions of the previous September 1993 were in my mind. That was one of the reasons why I backed away. I realized that, number one, I couldn't teach the class the way they wanted. Their organization has a right to expect this of me. It is their Sunday school. They said, would you teach this class according to these rules? I do believe that they have a right to ask that. But I also believe that I have a right to refuse. And that is what I exercise. So I don't really know that this is an incident of spiritual abuse. I taught four more times, and then discomfiture got really increased. But I do not live in fear of hellfire. I feel better than I ever have. I have lived my entire life in the church that I did not feel I belonged. I always felt I wasn't good enough. I never measured up. And that was one of the issues that clinched it for me. I finally said, I've got to get away from this. This is crazy making. I truly was being just driven to unhappiness. I could never measure up. I could never go to the temple enough. I could never work on welfare farm enough. Nothing that I could do would ever make me acceptable to myself or my Father in heaven. That issue has been resolved in my mind, which is, of course, after the fact. I now realize that if there is a God out there, He is not the hateful, vengeful God that killed the poor Soth that tried to study the ark of salvation. This is where I end John's story. There's more to it, of course. Is John's story about spiritual abuse or ecclesiastical abuse? I think so. Is John's story horrific? No, it is not. Do the events in this story reflect the potential of the ideas of Christ's church as revealed through Joseph Smith? I don't think so. Are the stories like this very common in the church? Yes. Janice Allred said the following in Volume 1 of the Case Reports, How to Read Bad News. I'm quoting, we believe that spiritual abuse is systemic in the church. It occurs because of widespread misunderstanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ and because of mistaken ideas about what it means to be a leader in the church. Our purpose in sharing these stories is to call attention to the problems of spiritual abuse in the church so that the problems can be understood and the remedy applied. These stories are not about bad leaders deliberately acting in abusive ways. They are about leaders who think they are doing the right thing, who act according to their understanding of what their position requires them to do. The remedy for spiritual abuse is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Janice, of course, will have another session. I'm sure she'll talk more about that. In Volume 1, I refer you to 12 principles listed that the Alliance has identified as essential for a spiritual healthy church. And I will not repeat them here, but they are vital. Another common factor that I found among the people that I talked to, in addition to the question of whether it was spiritual abuse or not, was that these people were threatened because they thought that their salvation or spirituality was being threatened. John said that he now knows that he does not need to fear for his salvation. The following part of another story also shows this. This person received her notice of excommunication unexpectedly in the mail. She had been led to expect more discussion and review by the stake president. Her reaction was that she felt completely abandoned, completely alone. She was devastated. She said, "I felt like my identity had been stripped away from me. I also felt that being excommunicated meant that I wasn't spiritual anymore, that they took my spirituality away from me. It took me about 6 months to realize that there is a separation, and there are certain things they can take away and certain things they can't take away." A friend said to her, "You can't believe that they can take away your spirituality." She prayed, and her request for knowledge of God's continuing love was granted to her. She said, "The excommunications made me separate the gospel from the organization of the church and the God of truth, and God and truth from men and men's own interpretation." She continues, "I know who God is. The feeling I have of Him is more. I used to think of coming home from a date and you are 15 minutes past curfew and you are just about to walk in the door. You know that Dad's going to be there, be sitting on the couch. But my perception used to be that I would walk in and try to escape him. He would see me, point out what was wrong, and dismiss me, cast me out of his presence, and tell me to go to my room. It was stern and punishing. It was a very punishing God. But now I feel differently. I really feel like now to walk in, it's like, yeah, I'm 15 minutes late, and I want to sit down next to him. I want to sit down next to him. I know he's going to slide over and ask me to come and be there, and we're going to talk about it. And it has nothing to do with the rules. It has to do with me and his concern for me. He is not there to maintain the rules. He is there to help me attain salvation and become like him and learn what it is that he knows. My perception of God is completely different. I no longer feel like a God-fearing person." These are two examples that show that that those subject to spiritual abuse realize after their experience that the spiritual life or salvation was in their control. No one can threaten it or take it away. In closing, I'd like to offer a few modest proposals on some ways to protect against spiritual abuse in the church. Evaluate any teaching or practice that places someone else in control of another person's spiritual life or salvation. It seems to me that this is an essential concept, that there should be one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. Our scriptures tell us in Doctrine and Covenants, section 121, that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, that they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. Maybe we need to look at our practices and policies and see if there are ways to compensate for that nature and disposition rather than augment it. One way would be to minimize or remove situations where one person judges another to determine whether that person should be allowed to receive saving ordinances. How important is the concept of worthiness in the gospel of Jesus Christ? Should people be making decisions about other people's worthiness to receive the blessings of the church, which according to the church are only available through the church? Would it not be better to leave this to the judgment of God? The church claims to be the only source of authoritative ordinances essential for salvation. Why not give the ordinances and blessings freely, without qualification, without judgment, to those who ask? It seems to me that the claim of being the sole source of God's authority, with that claim comes the responsibility to give God's gifts freely to all His children who want them. Why is a revelation that was given not by commandment or constraint used to restrain those that the church will allow to receive its ordinances? Why does an ordinance that unites families forever in the hereafter divide them here on the earth? Unworthy members and non-members and children are not allowed to witness temple marriages. And why are significant financial donations required before a person can receive the blessings and ordinances of the church? I think we need to think about some of those things. Thank you for your time.
We have about 5 minutes for questions, so I'll ask you to either come up to the mic or somebody can repeat the question into the mic.
Sally and I are niece and nephew of Junius Stoll Romney and Ruth Stewart Romney, I'd like to ask a question of everyone in this room. Those would stand, please, who have covenanted with God to defend truth and virtue. Would you please remain standing? Every man here today who has entered a temple has made such a covenant. I'd like to call to those who are here that the majority of those standing are female. And I stand again with that covenant and would invite all those who are in this room to now stand with the promise that they will defend truth and virtue. Karen Maloney, a year ago, compared Lavina Fielding Anderson to Joan of Arc. I stood at the conclusion of her talk in recognition that you are more of a Joan of Arc to me in the quest that you have undertaken, and you, Lavina Fielding Anderson, have my full support.
I told Barnard when he helped me come up here that that was coercion. But since I am up here and since he has made that statement about Lavina, I would like to take the opportunity to put my name on that statement as well. Wholeheartedly, I support you, Lavina. I'm grateful we have you.
I'd like to thank everyone for their comments and for attending this session today. Thank you.